victory. The opposition leader, Venancio Mondlane, has repeatedly called on supporters to take to the streets over allegations of voter fraud, as well as Mozambique's debt crisis, corruption, and other issues. Mozambique authorities have unleashed a brutal crackdown on protesters, killing at least 24 people. If you can put those two issues together.
Briefly, let me just end with the Angola element first. I mean, we mentioned that Biden is going to Angola to counter the influence of China, but unfortunately, we haven't seen him doing anything different from what China has done over the past decade, which is to do economic and business deals with the government of Angola and forgetting to implement projects that benefit the rest of the population. And unfortunately, Biden seems to be missing an important opportunity to address serious human rights issues and economic and social inequalities that Angola has been married with over the past few years. We wanted to use also this opportunity to once again appeal to Biden to use this opportunity to at least get a public commitment from President João Lourenço that he will investigate the human rights abuses, especially those that were committed by his security forces, and all those accountable to account. And of course, the victims need to see mechanisms of redress. Now, going to your question about Mozambique, I mean, Angola and Mozambique are very similar countries. They come from very similar backgrounds, long civil wars, huge influence of the Cold War, and as a consequence of that, they have built these security forces that are very heavy-handed, ruthless, prepared to defend the country and the regime in place against an enemy, not necessarily prepared to defend the population and the citizens and the constitution. And what we have seen in Mozambique since elections is exactly that. It's a demonstration on how security forces are on the ground to protect the interests of a few group of people that belong to the ruling party. And they are ready to do anything for that, including killing protesters, unarmed protesters, killing children. We have documented that at least 10 children between 1 and 17 years have been killed by security forces, ready to use live ammunition against anyone that dares to go to the streets and challenges the government in place. We have thousands of Mozambicans almost every day going to the streets protesting in different manners, most of it peacefully. Against the election results. They believe the elections were rigged. The Constitutional Council is at the moment analyzing the evidence of rigging. But while the Constitutional Council waits to pronounce itself about the final results, the Mozambican people have the right to go out on the streets. The Constitution provides that, to go out on the streets and protest against what they felt was a flawed process. But the security forces have not allowed them to do that. They have used excessive force against protesters. As a consequence, we have dozens of people killed. Our partners on the ground are speaking about 67 people killed right now as we speak. And that is for what? For 6 weeks of protests. We have also documented cases where children were killed by live bullets, but many children were also seriously affected by the indiscriminate use of tear gas against residences.
Zenaida, we want to thank you so much for being with us. We will continue to cover these issues, both in Mozambique and Angola. Zenaida Machado is Angola and Mozambique senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. She was joining us from Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, formerly with the BBC. And we want to thank Antonio Tomás, Angolan scholar, associate professor of anthropology at University of California, Irvine. Coming up, as President Biden faces bipartisan criticism for pardoning his son Hunter, we'll speak to the Last Prisoner Project about the group's call for Biden to free federal prisoners held on marijuana charges. Stay with us. by the Angolan singer Lourdes Vandunum. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Biden's continuing to face criticism over his decision to issue a sweeping pardon to his son, Hunter Biden. But the president's decision has also brought renewed attention to the power of the presidential pardon. Biden's now facing renewed pressure to commute the sentences of death row prisoners and to pardon or grant clemency to political prisoners like indigenous leader Leonard Peltier, imprisoned in Florida, and the whistleblowers Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. The group Last Prisoner Project is calling on Biden to use his clemency power to free those still incarcerated in federal prison for cannabis crimes. We're joined now by Jason Ortiz, Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Last Prisoner Project. This is very interesting, Jason. I think they say that Hunter Biden has been clean for something like just over 5 years. Mm-hmm. His father has openly talked about his son, formerly an addict. And as he faces bipartisan criticism, talk about what you think this is an opening for.
Sure. So this is definitely an opening for folks to talk about exactly how expansive we can use the pardon power of the president to make sure that we're correcting the injustices that were done over the past 20 or 30 years when it comes to cannabis crimes. President Biden himself was actually one of the architects of the 1994 crime bill that created a lot of the outrageous sentences that we're now dealing with today. And so we're seeing that there are over 3,000 federal cannabis prisoners currently incarcerated on cannabis charges. And these are all folks that also have families and have parents and have loved ones. And we have examples like folks like Jonathan Wall, who is somebody that was a Maryland resident. He was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison for his first offense. And so while I can understand why the president wants to have compassion for his own son, where we're really getting frustrated is that he's refusing to extend that compassion to all the parents that are currently watching their kids waste away in prison. Mitzi Wall, who works with the organization Freedom Grow, is a mother of Jonathan Wall. She was joining me this past week when we had the congressional press conference, when we were joined by folks like James Clyburn, Congressman James Clyburn, asking for freedom and clemency for folks like Jonathan Wall. And so that's one example of 3,000 folks that are currently in prison. Some of the charges are far more egregious. Folks like Edwin Ruiz was sentenced to 40 years in federal prison in the 90s. And so he's someone that hasn't had a Christmas or holidays with his family. He has a son that's 27 years old. He's currently served 27 years of that federal sentence. He hasn't had a single Christmas with his son because of charges that were orchestrated and architected by President Biden, then as senator, in the crime bill. We have folks that are serving life sentences. Israel Lira, for trafficking charge, is currently sentenced on a life sentence for the same activity that is now legal across the country in 25 which different states, including trafficking. And so that would be the distribution of cannabis. And so there is a specific, you know, differentiation between what President Biden's previous pardons were intended to do, which was only covering things like simple possession, where right now we have folks that are serving decades for trafficking, which is exactly what the hundreds of legal cannabis businesses across the country are currently doing on a regular basis, including right in Washington, D.C. And so we're now seeing people sitting in prison for decades for the same activity that is currently generating tax revenue for cities and states across the country. We're paying for schools and building bridges with cannabis activity dollars, but still letting folks waste away in prison. And so while I can definitely understand why a father would want to have compassion for his son and avoid prison time for his son, we're really asking him to extend that same compassion to all the folks that he helped put in prison to begin with.
Jonathan, you mentioned the previous pardons for simple cannabis possession, but that hasn't led to the release of many of those incarcerated individuals. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So those pardons were for simple possession for folks that were currently charged on a federal possession charge. And now it is very rare for someone to actually serve prison time for a simple possession charge at the federal level. That generally happens to folks, somebody maybe got caught, they were smoking at a national park or some other sort of federal property where they were unaware of it, but there are nobody in prison for simple possession in the federal prison system whatsoever. So despite his pardoning of 6,000 charges, zero people were released. However, the charges that we're looking to actually have folks released for, things like cultivation of cannabis, sales of cannabis, those are the charges that folks are currently in prison for, and we want him to expand his use of the pardon to cover all cannabis crimes that are now legal in the majority of the country.
Yeah, and Jason, apologies, but Jason, during your press conference last week, you spoke of, quote, the heartbreaking number of Latino fathers incarcerated for life or near-life sentences. How do these cases reflect systemic inequalities in federal sentencing?
So we've seen for the past 50 years or so that the war on drugs has been racially motivated, specifically targeting young black and brown men, and many of those are Latinos. Here in the city of New York, there was millions of arrests. Across the country, we've seen countless young fathers that have been ripped from their families simply because they were trying to make money to help feed their families. And so I was somebody who was arrested in high school at the age of 16. I was lucky enough not to get incarcerated, but only because my parents were able to help me through this ridiculous legal process of keeping a 16-year-old out of prison. And so we're seeing across the country that while these laws are changing, the retroactive relief and the restorative justice for the folks that were impacted has not followed suit with all the cannabis profits that we're seeing developed across the country. And we know without a doubt that the war on drugs was and is still racially motivated, specifically targeting blacks and Latinos. And so we've yet to actually wrestle with that real racist history of the war on drugs. We're simply trying to just move on without addressing the past. And I think the president has an incredible opportunity now to really address the issues that have been developed over the last few years by taking real expansive action, using his clemency power to commute the sentences of the folks that are currently in prison. And roughly half of the folks that are on our list of constituents are Latino. And you can see very clearly just by looking down the list of names who is in there and who is getting out, in the future. And Latinos are definitely overrepresented in the prison population generally, but especially in the federal system for cannabis crimes.
So, if you look at the clemency statistics by president, Biden is at almost the lowest outside of George H.W. Bush. Biden, Trump, Obama, W, Clinton, H.W., and Reagan. He's number two, among the lowest. Are you speaking directly, are your groups speaking directly with the Biden clemency office? How far are these demands going? You're talking about thousands of people.
Yeah, so we have met with White House officials multiple times, and we've explained exactly the folks that we believe are the top candidates for clemency. And while they have been receptive, they have not told us that they're going to take any particular action to help these folks out at all. And so what we are really doing is hoping that they will take action sooner rather than later. It is true that most of the time, most presidents use their clemency powers at the very end of their presidency. However, President Biden has clearly shown that he's not going to wait for everyone to wait until the end of his presidency. He was willing to do it a little bit earlier for his son. And so we're asking him to extend the same grace and compassion to all the folks that are currently incarcerated and release them immediately. Let them join their families for the holidays. Let them see their families grow up and bring joy and happiness back into their lives. These are folks that have served a tremendous amount of time already. This is not folks that we're saying did not commit the crime and should be, you know, released without any sort of punishment. Folks like Edwin Ruiz have already served 27 years of their life in federal prison for a cannabis charge. And so while he could wait, we are asking him not to wait, to do this immediately, to show the people that his presidency is going to be one where he will be remembered as addressing the issues that he created and coming to this from a place of compassion and not continuing the process and continuing the damage done by punitive drug policies.
Well, Jason Ortiz, we thank you so much for being with us, Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Last Prisoner Project. Coming up, Israeli journalist, former conscientious objector Haggai Matar, about Gaza and Israel's crackdown on the press. Stay with us. Thank you. is our mother, Bhagyanavya. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel's renewed its attacks on southern Lebanon, killing at least 12 people, threatening to further unravel Israel's truce with Hezbollah. With the latest attacks, the UN says Israel's committed more than 100 ceasefire violations since agreeing to a ceasefire last week. Meanwhile, Israel's continued its unrelenting assault on Gaza with attacks on the northern town of Beit Lahia today that killed at least 8 people. 20 others are wounded. In Gaza City, dozens of civilians are feared trapped under the rubble of a 4-story building leveled by an Israeli airstrike. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the situation in Gaza appalling and apocalyptic and said Israel may be guilty of the gravest international crimes. We're joined now by the Israeli journalist and activist Haggai Matar. He's an executive director of Plus 972 magazine and conscientious objector who refused to serve in the Israeli army. He has a new piece in The Nation out today, For Those Who Know They Have Not Done Enough to Stop Israel's War on Gaza. It's nice to have you in studio. We usually speak to you in Tel Aviv, Haggai.
It's good to be here.
So, elaborate on that title in The Nation, the piece that you just wrote, For Those Who Do Not Feel They've Done Enough.
Sure, Amy. So first, it started from a Yom Kippur reflection of myself, of why have I not done enough? I've been running 972, co-directing Local Call in Hebrew, trying to fight for the rights of Palestinians and push back against the horrific acts of massacre and ethnic cleansing my country's been committing in Gaza. And yet it feels like it's just not enough. And why have we not done enough? What could we possibly do more? So it started with a very personal reflection, trying to analyze the reasons of not doing enough, and then saying, well, we have to commit, we have to double down. And especially now with the upcoming Trump presidency, I think this is also a call to Americans saying, your government is clearly not going to get any better at this in the near future. We need people on the ground mobilizing and taking action, supporting BDS, trying to move the needle and pressuring Israel into ending these atrocities.
And Guy, I wanted to ask you about the International Criminal Court's historic decision to indict Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. In a statement, the ICC said that the Israeli leaders had, quote, intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival. How was this news received within Israel? And do you think it will have, in the long term, a major impact on Netanyahu and the policies of his government?
Well, thank you, Juan. One of the most heartbreaking realities of the situation is that Israelis don't get the news that everyone else in the world is getting. The images from Beit Lahia and from Jabalia, the just atrocities we're seeing there, the death, the destruction, the starvation, that is not being shown on Israeli television, Israeli newspapers. And therefore, when something like this comes out, a decision from the ICC, basically their response from wall to wall, we're talking about the entire Zionist politics, so that's about 110 out of 120 members of the Knesset, are just saying, this is an anti-Semitic court. This is anti-Semitic media. Like, everyone is anti-Semitic. And of course, you know, just offering complete support to Netanyahu, even the people who hate him the most. An exception to that has been, in recent days, Moshe Bogi Yaalon, a former chief of staff, was actually the chief of staff that sent me to 2 years in prison for his war crimes, now saying, yes, these warrants are justified.
The Prime Minister. I want to go to that for 1 minute. Clip of the former defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, accusing Israel of ethnic cleansing and committing war crimes in Gaza. Again, served as the defense minister of Netanyahu from 2013 to 16. Made the accusations over the weekend in main television interviews on Channel 12, for example, one of Israel's biggest TV channels.
To occupy, to annex, to cleanse ethnic cleansing. Look at the northern Gaza Strip and settle a Jewish settlement. That's the point. There's no Beit Lahia. There is no Beit Hanon. They are operating in Jabalia and are essentially clearing the area of Arabs.
So that's a main Israeli channel, not actually Channel 12, Israel's former defense minister, Moshe Ya'alon. Hagai Matar, does he speak to the Israeli public and explain more the significance of who he is?
So Ya'alon was the chief of staff in the Second Intifada. That's when I refused the draft because of his war crimes. We were at the time chanting at him, "One day we'll see you at The Hague." We never imagined it would be as a witness for the prosecution. To suddenly see him talking about the same sort of actions that he was doing, but clearly much, much worse right now, the ethnic cleansing things, the starvation that he's enforcing, is absolutely incredible. He's doing it as part of his attempt to fight against the Netanyahu drive for authoritarianism. So he's been very active in the kind of so-called Israeli protest for democracy, even before the war in Gaza. That has been his policy. I think he connects the dots, as one should, between the attack on democratic institutions inside of Israel and the ethnic cleansing and massacre and war crimes against Palestinians. However, unfortunately, in interviews where he's been going on Israeli television, basically from wall to wall, journalists have been saying, "Are you mad? You're just endangering our soldiers. What are you talking about? There's no war crimes." So because viewers don't have the context of what has actually been happening, he just sounds like a madman to many people. But I do think it does cause some people pause to think, why would someone with his credentials make such serious accusations?
Hagai, you asked if people are doing enough. I want to break into this conversation with this breaking news. In Canada, about 150 Jewish activists and allies have just launched a protest inside the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa to demand Canada stop arming Israel. We're joined now by Rachel Small, a member of the group Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition. Rachel, can you describe where you are and what you're doing and what you're calling for?
Thank you. We are in a Parliament Hill building right now. We have completely taken over the lobby of this building that has hundreds of parliamentarians' office in here. Our demand is clear. Canada needs to stop arming Israel and implement an immediate arms embargo. We know that every F-35 fighter jet, every Boeing Apache helicopter dropping bombs on Lebanon and Gaza right now is full of hundreds of Canadian components. We're here as Jews to say this violence cannot continue in our name. And we're here as people of conscience to say that the absolute bare minimum Canada needs to be doing right now is stop arming a genocide.
All who hold onto it in strength will
thrive. Hagai Matar, your response to these kinds of actions occurring abroad, does this have an impact on the Israeli public?
Well, first of all, I want to commend the activists on the ground now in Ottawa. It's incredible. This is the exact kind of protest that people should be taking on in Canada, definitely in the U.S., which is the biggest supplier of weapons and funding and diplomatic support to Israel. So, yes, this is what we should be seeing more of. I'm afraid that in Israel, again, these protests are usually seen as anti-Semitic, or in the case of Jews protesting, so self-hating Jews or people that are, you know, unhinged. That's the way it's being perceived. It's our job as Jewish Israelis on the ground, talking in Hebrew, talking to people in our communities, to try and help them understand that it's not the world that's gone mad. It's us.
Interesting that the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, just met with President-elect Trump in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Rachel Small, we're looking at the group of people. One of them, I think, says Jews for Free Palestine. What has been Trudeau's position and what's going to happen to you this morning?
We have seen an unprecedented wave of resistance across Canada over the past 13 months. Many, many thousands of people across the country, not only petitioning their MPs, not only protesting, not only meeting with them, but actually holding blockades at weapons factories, doing literally everything they can to get Canada to stop arming Israel. And that pressure has resulted in the Canadian government taking a stance that we would have not thought possible a year or two ago. They have committed to stop arming Israel. They have, in fact, the Foreign Affairs Minister recently, in fact, said that Canadian weapons are not going to be going and used in Gaza. Unfortunately, it's not true. Unfortunately, we know that they have not canceled all the permits, and they have continued to conveniently send weapons to the U.S. without even requiring a permit. Those are going into every F-35 Israel is using. That is going into Israel's primary weapons of war. So we have backed the Canadian government into a corner where they know what the right stance is. They know they need to stop arming Israel, and we're here to make sure they do it. The broad arms embargo now coalition has come together across the country and has in fact gotten 45 parliamentarians to formally endorse the call for an arms embargo. We just need the government to step up and take that action to actually cut off the flow of all weapons to and from Israel. It's the bare minimum they need to be doing.
That's Rachel Small, member of Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition. If you're having a little trouble understanding her, she's inside the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa. There are scores of people behind her. Lead Canadian organizer with the group World Beyond War. And in the studio with us in New York, though usually in Tel Aviv, is Hagai Matar, Israeli journalist, activist, executive director of 972 Magazine, a conscientious objector himself. Juan?
Hagai, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about the president-elect Trump's decision to select former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee as the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. Huckabee is not only a leading U.S. Christian Zionist who's openly advocated for Israel's annexation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. He declared in 2008 that there's really no such thing as a Palestinian. What do you expect from this kind of ambassador from the new Trump administration?
So obviously, Trump appointments and Trump policies are terrifying to us and should be to anyone who cares about the rights of Palestinians. I do want to also point out, however, Trump policies have an inherent contradiction. As an isolationist, Trump does not want to get involved in too many wars. As someone who wants to break deals with Saudi Arabia and Arab Gulf states, he may want to ensure that they don't drift into the Iran-China field of influence. And those two policies, being pro-annexation and pro-settlements and pro-Israel, and being pro-war and wanting to sign deals, they collide. And I think it's our role on the left to kind of put a wedge in there and try and make sure that it becomes more and more apparent how those policies conflict with each other.
Hagai Matar, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Israeli journalist, activist, executive director of Plus 972 Magazine, former conscientious objector, refused to serve in the Israeli army. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Emily Goslin. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Jarena Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Anna Elias, Dennis Moynihan, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hey, Canada. We need to talk. Canadians want a healthy climate, but things keep getting worse. Horrendous wildfires, extreme heat, too much rain, or extended drought. You don't have to face this alone. With Citizens Climate Lobby Canada, you can do a lot. Working together, we can create lasting climate solutions. Visit citizensclimatelobby.ca and step into your power with Citizens Climate Lobby Canada.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.